This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello everyone and welcome to the special post-international break edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks, the podcast that puts La Professeur into Arsene Wenger, whatever that means. I'm Sam Matterface from ITV and Talk Sport.
I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
I'm Alex Crook from Talk Sport and national newspaper journalist.
I'm former England right-back Danny Mills.
Coming up this week, we will be welcoming the return of the Premier League, how an England star is struggling with his injury, and giving you our favourite stats ahead of the weekend.
I'll be discussing the perils of sitting on a cracking story for three long weeks ahead of this week's big South Coast showdown.
I'll be giving you insight into life as a BBC pundit.
Also find out what it's like to go from covering a club in League One to the Premier League.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, it feels like an absolute age since we were all together with Danny Higginbottom. So did you enjoy the international break? I mean, traditionally, it's not something that we look forward to.
Yeah, no, I know for you guys, you're just... You go dark, you go quiet. I still do a game. I did Exeter City at the weekend against Swindon, which actually wasn't that exciting. But I've been learning to play golf. That was my highlight of the international break.
Four.
Keep shouting that whenever I'm near the tee.
It was pretty dull as always. I did do Israel-Scotland with Chris Iwelemu, who was wonderfully passionate. It's just a shame the Scottish players did not quite show the same level of passion on the pitch.
I did Northern Ireland twice.
Oh, he's such a nice guy.
And they missed chance after chance after chance. They hit the post three times in one game and at least two open goals. I mean, it was just like you were pulling your hair out. And the worst thing was, I was doing the Northern Ireland game, came out at half time to find out how England were getting on, and they were winning 3-0 against Spain.
Oh.
I thought,
oh.
You know, like, I don't mind. I love doing Northern Ireland and Scotland. I've done them all over the last couple of years. But that's one day when you really want to be watching England, isn't it? Anyway, enough said. Let's go over that and look ahead to some of the big games that we've got coming up this week in numbers. Jose Mourinho returns to Chelsea on Saturday with his future at Manchester United still very much in doubt, thanks in part to Paul Scholes. And it's easy to see why when you consider that the Portuguese has picked up 17 less wins in his 84 games at Old Trafford than in his first 84 games at Stamford Bridge.
It could be another tough weekend for Huddersfield. I know a lot of people had them as one of the favourites, so to speak, to go down. They're entertaining Liverpool. The Terriers are without a win in 12 matches. That's their worst run in 18 years.
If Huddersfield stay up, I'll do the last podcast of the season naked. Wilfried Zaha suffered an injury scare playing for the Ivory Coast. If he doesn't line up for Crystal Palace at Everton on Sunday, get your money on a home win. Palace have lost their last 13 matches. He's not started.
He's going to be out for quite a while, isn't he, Wilfried Zaha? So that's going to be a real problem for Crystal Palace, I think. And in terms of you doing anything naked, I think all of us are now turning into Terrier supporters. One of the issues with the international break is the big gap between the Premier League matches, especially if you've been sitting on a potentially explosive interview that you want to roll out ahead of a local derby. And that's something that you've been trying to do, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, this was an interview actually I carried out in the mix zone, the good old mix zone, after Bournemouth's last home game. That was against Palace on a Monday night. So it's actually 3 weeks ago. They've had a game at Watford since then. And I was speaking to Steve Cook, and Bournemouth put the fixtures on a sort of poster behind him in the mix zone. So I said, I'm just looking over your shoulder, Cookie. You've got Southampton in a couple of weeks. That's a big game. I wasn't expecting too much from it, but actually he's given me some really nice lines, quite provocative lines, saying that Bournemouth are now the top team in the South Coast. Basically, Southampton only stayed up last season because Bournemouth was so poor at St Mary's. He made a mistake. They won the game, and that pretty much kept Saints in the league. So
that doesn't sound as hard as you told it to me. You asked him a question. Are you ready to take over the mantle of Southampton's stature as the biggest team on the South Coast? And he said, we already have, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I said, is there a desire to be the biggest team in the South Coast? And he said, I think we are the top team in the South Coast because, of course, they finished above everyone in the league last season. It was the line that got me was where he said, you know, we effectively kept them up. And I thought, well, that's really good stuff because it's an interesting rivalry, this one. Southampton fans are reluctant to call it a derby. They still see Bournemouth as the poor relations. But actually, if you look at the last couple of seasons, it doesn't really tally with that. Bournemouth finished above them in a higher finishing position for the first time in their history last season. They're sixth. Southampton are 2 points off the bottom three. Can't buy a win. They can't sell out the stadium. They had to sell tickets on Groupon for the Brighton game recently. That's just embarrassing.
I know. Bournemouth, that's cringe, isn't it?
Bournemouth need a new ground to fit all their newfound supporters in. So I think the balance of power is shifting. But to get someone like Steve Cook to come out and say that, that's going to make really good newspaper coverage for the weekend. But I've had to sit on it for 3 weeks. The guy from the local paper was there, so I've had to do all kinds of deals with him not to run it early so that I get first dibs, because it was my line of questioning. You hope Steve Cook doesn't pick up an injury in training, because, of course, that would scupper if he wasn't playing. So it's been anxious, but I think it will finally see the light of day in Friday's papers.
Yeah, that'll get people a bit fired up on the South Coast. That'd be a really nice line.
Sitting on a story for 3 weeks is a really difficult thing to do, because if you get a whiff of something happening, sometimes you think, I've just got to get it, especially in this current climate where social media is so prevalent. You almost feel as if as soon as you find something out, you've got to get it out there. And there is a bit of an arms race amongst journalists to try and be the first to break the story. But I remember a situation where I found out that Carlo Ancelotti had been taken into a room at Goodison Park straight after the end of the season and was going to be sacked as the manager of Chelsea. And I had a very small window of time to get on air and break that story. And literally it happened within about a minute. That is not something that you can sit on. And there's so much danger, and it is a bit about sort of being in the right place at the right time. You pick that up because you asked the right question. But also, you then got to trust the colleagues and the relationships that you've made that they don't leak it.
Yeah, and I remember, similar to you, when Nigel Adkins was fired by Southampton a few years ago, I got the name Maurizio Pochettino before anybody else. But literally, I had to get it out there and then without necessarily being able to double and triple check it, because Southampton actually called a press conference for that afternoon. So I had about an hour to try and get it out before everybody else.
Can I just add to that as well? Do you think now, especially for you, Crook, maybe as a written journalist, is there sort of a clamour when something happens to be the first, also like to put it on social media, to be that first person? Is that like a real thing, would you say, for written journalists now?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a competition element to that. But it's interesting, actually, and we could have a wider debate about this, that the benefits of Twitter and even newspaper websites compared to the actual print versions of newspapers. Because I was speaking to a long-serving hack yesterday, and he made the point to me, he still doesn't understand why newspapers give away their information for free. i.e. they put it on Twitter or they put it on websites where you don't have to pay for the information. And that is killing newspapers. But as I say, that opens up a whole new debate, maybe for a future time.
The problem is it's very difficult to enforce that, because so many people want to get the story out, and you use so many freelancers in a newspaper and in radio industry, and so many people work for themselves, that it's important for them to establish themselves. So everyone's fighting for airtime. So it's a real tricky one, because I know exactly what it means. In terms of information, that's the currency that newspapers deal in.
Remember, you can follow on Instagram or get in touch with us via Twitter. The handles are the same, @AFCGeeks. Send us any burning questions you have for us.
Tweet the Geeks @AFCGeeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, it's time for us to prove just how geeky we really are as we play Stat or Spin. Sam, do you want to start us off?
Lift off and the clock has started.
Yeah, okay. I'm off to Huddersfield against Liverpool this weekend for Talk Sport. Huddersfield 18th in the Premier League. They're yet to win a game. But did you know they also became the first side in Premier League history to start the season without scoring a goal, a solitary goal, in their first four home games? Is that stat or spin?
I thought they did score in one of their first home games. I'm sure they score. I'm pretty sure they must have scored in their first four home games. I'm going to say that's spin.
Okay.
I think it's a stat, because I think they scored at Goodison Park against Everton, but I'm not sure they've scored at home.
Okay, well, they haven't scored a home goal. Sorry, Michelle. But it is spin, because actually Crystal Palace became the third team to do this season when they lost at Wolves 1-0 before the international break. But Everton were the first in 98-99. But the only other time it's happened in the history of the top flight was when West Bromwich Albion failed to score in their first home games of the season, four home games of the season, in 1921-22. So that just underlines how bad Huddersfield have been. Crook, what you got for us?
Okay, Brighton head to Newcastle this weekend. Not only have they not won away from home in the league this season, if they don't win on Saturday. It will be the first time in their history they've gone a whole year, 12 months, without picking up a victory in the league on the road.
Ooh, that's a stat, I think.
That's I think that's specific. A stat. I'm going to say stat because that is so specific. I'm going to go stat as well, Sam.
Well, their last away win in the Premier League was on the 20th of October 2017, so it will be a whole year if they failed to win at St James's Park, but it won't be the first time. It will be the first time since 1935 that they've done that.
It's a long time, isn't it? That's bad news as well for Chris Hughton, because you look at the table and you think Huddersfield and Cardiff are two worst teams than them, but you do have to pick up points on your travels. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how good you are at home, you're going to find yourself in a serious situation. Michelle, what you got?
Okay, so I am at Brentford against Bristol City this weekend. My first trip to Brentford, looking forward to it. Under their new boss, of course, Thomas Frank. It'll be the first time he's in charge of the team on Saturday. Now, Dean Smith has obviously been in charge so far of Brentford, and he has been playing the youngest average starting 11 in the Championship this season. Is that a stat or spin?
Yeah, I think that's a stat. I can't imagine that anybody else has got a younger team than them. They're quite good on recruiting. I know the chairman, actually, well, the owner, Matthew Benham. I met him a couple of times, and he's massively into the way that the business behind the scenes is run and how they do the scouting. They do it very differently to everybody else. They use algorithms and all sorts. So I'm going to suggest that that's true. That's a stat.
I agree, because I think it's too random for Michelle to have made it up.
Yeah, I'm not that clever to make that up. It is a stat. Average age is 24 years and 114 days.
Wow, that's impressive, isn't it?
On the way next, we will be joined by former England defender Danny Mills to reflect on that glorious night in Seville. And we'll also find out how the relationship between players and the media has changed from his time with the Golden Generation to Gareth Southgate's Young Lions.
Well, on the back of a particularly successful international break for England, who better to be this week's special guest than someone who knows what it's like to be on the inside of the Three Lions camp as both a player and as a pundit? It's the BBC's Danny Mills. Hello, Danny.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. I read this tweet from Henry Winter, the chief football writer at The Times this week, and said that the first half against Spain earlier this week was the best performance that he'd seen by an England team since the game against Denmark in the World Cup of 2002. You played in that game, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I just feel that the media pundits have got a little bit carried away. It is an outstanding result. Absolutely brilliant to go away to Spain with the youngest squad ever and to beat them on their own patch is nothing but remarkable. But it has to be a sort of a dose of realism. And obviously, I know Gareth well, and he will look at the game maybe slightly differently. It's not just about the result. The performance was fantastic, but I think you have to accept England cannot play that way and win a tournament in that way. And I don't like stats. You know, it's not what I'm all about, because they don't always tell the whole story, as they don't in this case. But Spain, 24 shots at goal, 13 on target, 73% possession, 12 corners, and Pickford had to make 8 saves. You flip that the other way, England had 5 shots, 4 on target, 27% possession, and De Gea only had 1 save to make. Now, that's brilliant, because England win 3-2. But long term, you can't get away with that to win a competition against the better sides in the world when you come up against Brazil, France, Croatia. We saw that in the World Cup. So, yes, in its own right, brilliant performance. First 45 minutes was executed perfectly. But then I still think we came under pressure second half and were a little bit fortunate, some of the refereeing decisions. But equally, you have to say, OK, result done, and the players will learn an awful lot from that second half.
It's interesting you say the media have got carried away, and I think it's something we've all been accused of in previous tournaments. As a player, when you're in that England camp, how much do you read newspapers? How much do you pay attention to what the pundits are saying on television? Are you acutely aware of the sort of hysteria that's being built up, particularly in a tournament environment?
Yeah, that's twofold. What do we read? Every single word, without a shadow of a doubt. Those that say they don't... Yeah, but we're all egomaniacs. you know, let's be honest, we all want to know what people are saying about us. If it's great, you tend to pay a little bit more attention to it. If it's not, you go, hey, what does he know? And you chuck it away. But you do read everything. And from time to time, you know, you want to know what people think of you. You know, have you know within yourself if you've played well. But sometimes you think, well, actually, I've done okay. You know, and most players, I believe, are very self-critical at times. You know, there's no such thing as the perfect performance. That happened to me during the World Cup. There were some good performances, but I criticised myself quite heavily in certain things in 2002. So you come out of that and think, well, actually, and then you read the press think you've done really well. Sometimes, actually, it can work the other way, and it can give you a little bit of a boost.
In terms of your own career, why did you decide to go into the media rather than go into the coaching career? Because after playing for England, for Manchester City, for Leeds, you know, having a very, very good career, why did you decide that this was the route for you?
I finished very early. I got some really bad injuries from sort of 27 onwards, two broken legs, and then came back from those and then went to Derby on loan after being at Charlton for 6 months, just trying to get fit, and then twisted my knee after two games. And that was it. Came off against Portsmouth, never played again. 30 years old, career finished, retired. I went through 2 years of rehab, trying to get fit, decided that wasn't going to work. And then I had a year out and thought, I'm just going to have a year out and do whatever. I'd done my badges during that sort of period, sort of B license, etc. And then I really struggled for that year. I thought, you know what, I'm going to do nothing. I've got four young kids at the time, probably all under 10, I think, looking back, and just thinking, actually, what do I want to do? What I really struggled with was having the freedom to choose. So normally as a player, you get told when to get up, when to eat, when to train, when to have a day off, when to travel, when to do this. Coaching, I just thought, I need a break from football. I needed to get out of it. So for a year, I did nothing and hated it. I nearly went mad, went insane, drove the whole family crazy. And then had a choice, and I thought coaching was too intensive for me. It was 24/7, day in, day out. And did I want to work with people like me all the time? No, was the honest answer. Could I put up with one of me? Not really. Could I put up with 25 of me? Certainly not. So I decided that coaching wasn't really where I wanted to go with it. And I think before, and this is probably going to sound a bit, no surprise, egotistical, if you like, but I'd always been shoved out to do interviews when I was a player, and I'd built up sort of some relationships. I always had an opinion. I would never shirk an interview. And I was relatively intelligent. So whenever we had issues, and we had quite a few at Leeds, you know, going back with court cases and administrations and all sorts of stuff, I was always pushed forward to do the media. And because of that, I sort of built a relationship with some of the sort of my now colleagues within that sort of, within radio and TV. And they just said, look, you know, just fancy doing bits and pieces. So I just started doing games. And I did my first one while I was still playing or injury. 2003, I did Match of the Day. And I remember it well because it was when Paul Pesce-Schlido had that header and David Seaman did that amazing claw save in the semi-final of the FA Cup. And I just sort of fell into it, really. And I won't lie, I didn't like watching football when I played. I detested it. You know, if it was about me, it was fine. And it was about me learning, then I had no issue with that whatsoever. But watching other teams, other people, just didn't really interest me. But obviously, I had to learn quite quickly to pay a little bit more attention to what other people were doing.
You mentioned there that you're never scared to voice an opinion. I've picked up an old article from the BBC website when you got a bit of criticism, actually, for something you said on 606. You described Stuart Pearce as not being a great coach. Does that cause problems between you guys now when you see each other in press rooms and out and about on the circuit?
He's not the friendliest towards me, put it that way. But I quantify it. I said, look, I grew up watching Stuart Pearce, legend. And this is the problem, and we all do it in the press. Things get taken out of context at times. I said, legendary player, incredible fullback. But when I had him as a coach and some of the things that went on, that I've never really gone into in depth, I didn't like and didn't sit with me. You know, joining in training sessions all the time, putting goalkeepers up front. You know, he made me, I was the sub-goalkeeper for long periods of that Man City regime. He put five outfield players on the bench and was quite happy if something went wrong for me to go in goal. There were things that I didn't enjoy during that period. And I watched, it was a difficult dressing room. You know, it wasn't easy for Stuart's first job. Myself, Ben Thatcher, Richard Dunn, Robbie Fowler, Steve McManaman, Nicholas Anelka, Claudio Reyna, David James. It was like, that was tough. But yeah, so I didn't like his methods of coaching. I didn't like the way he dealt with some of the players, not just me, the way that I saw other things. And I just, you know, people ask me my opinion and I will always be honest and I will back it up. If people don't like it, then, well, I'm sorry. But I always think you choose to be offended.
Do you make a conscious effort to be a pundit that doesn't sit on the fence?
No, it's just how I am. Cantankerous, miserable, as my wife would say. That's pretty much my general persona most of the time. I have an opinion in whatever it is, and that's how I've always sort of run my life. That's how I run my business life. I'm very pragmatic, very logical in what I do. There's not an awful lot of emotion, which is bizarre. The way I played, I got over emotional at times and, you know, a little bit het up and things came out, the red mist came down. But I live it very, very practically and logically, and this is a matter of fact. I don't get upset much. I don't get overexcited. Again, to my family, like you know, sometimes they'll be like, did you enjoy that? Oh, yeah, I loved it. Well, it's like, could you tell your face? Because we don't really know, you know, what's going on at times. So I don't do it deliberately, but I won't back down. I'll back up my opinions, and if I have my beliefs, I'll stick by it.
And obviously, you work in both forms. You're a pundit for Five Live. You sat on the Match of the Day panel. You've been a co-commentator for BBC TV as well. Which of those guys do you feel most comfortable in?
Do you know what? I like it all. There is something very special about the radio that I really do enjoy. And as you guys know, radio doesn't pay as well as TV. So it's nice to have a mixture of both. I just think with radio, and when you're doing the commentaries and you're at the ground and you're surrounded by everything, you can go off the beaten track a little bit. TV commentary is very rigid. You have to talk about exactly what's happening, why it's happening, and that's it. You know, you cannot divert. Whereas sometimes, and we all know, there are a lot of really bad games that you have to go and watch and commentate on. But then you can talk about, you know, we went for a run around the down the river, or we went for a meal last night, we bumped into some fans, and you know, and you can open it up and have a conversation. I always think most people listening to the radio probably sat in their cars or travelling of some description. I'm not sure that many people listen to the radio at home anymore. So you're thinking, actually, you want to be entertained. It's not just about the game when you're on radio. So I find that more enjoyable. TV I like, but I prefer the punditry as in analysis of doing bits and pieces of why this went wrong, why that went wrong, which is almost like, I suppose, coaching without the responsibility.
I always think now that no one wants to be the TV co-commentator. No one wants to do it, do they? It's one of the things that people just don't want to be involved in. And I wonder whether or not that's because of the social media backlash, because of the pressure that comes with it, especially if it's England. There's, you know, at times 30 million people watching over a World Cup or a European Championship. Are you conscious of that?
No, I don't mind that. And I think, you know, I accept that, you know, I'm not a big enough name to sit on Match of the Day or Sky Sports or whatever and do big internationals and that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to be the face. I'm not going to be the Alan Shearer or the Thierry Henry or Jamie Carragher, whoever it is. I never got to that sort of level to be that person. But can I do a co-com? Yeah. You know, you need experience of having been in that situation, of knowing what it's like. So I think you have to learn and accept where your level is. I think too many people just want to be the face on TV, or they just want to be the main guy on the radio. And I think that's why we've seen a lot of the players that are now finishing, they do it for 6 months, think it's great, and then there's all the travelling, all the this, all the that, all the other bits and pieces that they have to do, and actually they go, oh, actually it's harder work than I thought it was.
Got to do a bit of press.
Well, yeah, and got to do a bit of work, in all honesty. You know, the first 6 months you can get away with just being a name and having just finished. After that, you've got to put in some serious hours.
Brilliant stuff as always. Danny, are you okay to take our quick fire quiz where we try and get sort of like some more interesting offbeat stories from your world of your commentary travels? It's very, very quick and sharp. Are you up for it?
I am indeed. Nothing's off limits.
Okay, here we go then. First of all, what is the one thing that you take with you to every game?
My iPad.
Which commentator keeps you on your toes the most?
John Murray.
What's the name you've most struggled to get your tongue around?
Oh, there are quite a few. Johan Bash. Any Spanish names with names in the end of it that I never seem to be able to get.
Your favourite app or website to help preparation for games?
Forza Football.
Your worst journey?
Several in Brazil with a certain BBC commentator that will not be mentioned.
Worst place you've ever stayed on your commentary travels?
Oh, worst place. Where was it? I think it was Moldova. I think England played Moldova. Jack Wilshere played. They went 1-5-0. I mean, the hotel, it was one of those silly hotels where you get those huge square pillows. The bed was about a foot wide. It was just awful. And you went to the restaurant and just thought, no, I wouldn't let my dogs eat here.
Who's the most accommodating club in the Premier League?
Chelsea are always very, very good, bizarrely. But they don't really like Leeds. But they're always like really good, and they tend to recognise you on your way in, which is always quite nice.
Nobody likes Leeds. If you go back in time and commentate
everybody
one,
loves Leeds.
If you could go back in time and commentate one sporting moment, what would it be?
One sporting moment. I know a lot of people go for the World Cup. I think it would have to be Usain Bolt winning his third 100 metre Olympics. I mean, that was just sensational. Either that or Mo Farah when he won, you know, in London. Just moments that are very, very unlikely to ever, ever happen again.
And finally, what one change would you make to make the job easier?
I really don't know, to be honest. Is it that difficult? I don't think it's that hard. I quite like it. I quite like the challenge. Do you know what? I would have bigger press seats and a bigger press box so we could spread out a little bit, because you guys will know some of them are so small, so cramped, you can barely get a phone on the desk, let alone an iPad.
Yeah, especially if you're the size of Alex as well, in which case it's just really
creature. I'm all for creature comforts.
I thought he was calling me a creature then.
Brilliant. Danny, thank you very much. Cheers,
Dan. Pleasure. Not a problem.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, since we started the podcast, we've been focused mainly on what it's like covering games for national and international media. But most journalists and broadcasters start their careers working for local newspapers or radio stations. In my case, actually playing records on hospital radio. That's a true story. And you've done that as well, didn't you? Michelle and Crook, you all started locally.
Yeah. I have.
Yeah,
I
not
have
not hospital
been,
radio.
Crook, you haven't lived. So we sent Crook to Brighton to chat to longtime BBC Sussex commentator Johnny Canter to get an insight into how his job has changed following the Seagulls' rise from League One to the Premier League.
OK, we are sat at the Amex Stadium under glorious October sunshine, actually. I'm with Johnny Canter, who is the main football commentator for BBC Sussex. Johnny, how many years have you been covering the Seagulls?
It's just coming up to 10 years.
And in that time, you'd have followed the club in League One, into the Championship, and of course, a couple of years ago, promoted to the Premier League. What's the big difference in terms of your role now that they're with the big boys?
Well, that's one, that we're sitting in this stadium rather than around a running track, obviously, because when I first joined, they were at the Widdeen Stadium. Obviously, it's been huge investment from a chairman who's also a fan. But really, you know, now things have gone global. You know, there was a day when the likes of myself and maybe Andy Naylor, who some people may know, who writes for the Argus, and he's been doing it a little bit longer than I have, probably 20, 25 years. You know, it was just the two of us who were sat on the side of maybe, you know, at Rochdale or Oldham, you know, doing the post-match interviews with the likes of Russell Slade, whereas now obviously it's a global sort of environment and arena that they're in, and like tonight there's a host of TV cameras, so it's all a little bit different for us, I suppose.
Have you had to sharpen your game a bit, because in the past it was just you and Andy Naylor competing for stories, whereas now they could emerge from anywhere?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we have to, you know, as I say, there's one story, when people come down here they tell that story, but for us we've got to find different stories. You know, whether it's, you know, the chairman, sit down with him, because he doesn't do that many interviews, so that's quite a rarity, so you've got to make those count. But at the same time, it's maybe the fan who's, you know, 90 35 and has been supporting them since the Goldstone Ground in 1965.
Countless examples of clubs in the Premier League where, as a journalist now, it's just a no-go area. You can't get access to players. Has that become more difficult in the Premier League?
I think it's become a little bit more difficult. I think, you know, as a, I suppose, a local journalist, you do get, well, this club is very good at helping the local journalists, and I've obviously built up relationships with a lot of players over a decade or so.
How many players' phone numbers have you got?
A fair few, but I mean, I suppose it gets every time there's a new player, and especially with the foreign players coming in, obviously they're a little bit more reluctant, but someone like, you know, a Bruno Figueiredo, obviously, who's key to the club, or Steve Sidwell, Liam Rossini, these people who've been at the club recently, you know, they're more than welcome to take a call with the club's blessing to talk about any sort of ongoing issues or any breaking stories.
And in terms of your match preparation, do you find that harder or easier now they're a Premier League club?
Well, it's a question I'm often asked that one, actually. I actually think it's easier because, obviously, they're playing against teams that everybody knows and there's more information readily available for teams in the Premier League. But, for instance, when I was going to, say, you know, MK Dons, and suddenly you see a name on the team sheet that you didn't recognise and hasn't been involved for them, has come straight out of the youth setup, you don't know anything about them. But, obviously, 99% of our listeners on our commentaries, it's not like I'm doing it for Radio 5 Live, are Brighton fans. So they just, I would be objective. I work for the BBC. I don't work for the club. You know, I'm actually just trying to see it through their eyes. So if they're losing, how can they turn it round and do that kind of analysis? So that's always a major factor in our commentaries.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting that he said that he still got most of the players' phone numbers, something that when you're working in local radio is so, so useful. But when you are doing a national radio station or a national television job, then it doesn't happen quite like that because you don't meet the same people week in, week out.
No, and I also think even if you are covering the same club week in, week out now at the Premier League level, unless it's Brighton or maybe even a Bournemouth, no disrespect to them, you're going to struggle to get a player's phone number because it's very rare that you're going to be in a situation where you're in a one-on-one environment where you can actually even ask for the mobile phone number without a press officer or such like cutting in. It reminds me actually of a time when Pompey were in the Premier League and I had every player's phone number then. It was fantastic. There were some great characters. And I remember calling Shaka Hislop, who was a lovely guy, one evening trying to get a preview for the game at the weekend. I think they may well have been going back to Newcastle. And he called me back. I was asleep at midnight that night to apologise that he couldn't take the call because he'd been at his daughter's parents' evening. Now, A, that's a very late parents' evening, but B, what a really genuinely nice thing to do.
Yeah, he was a great guy though, wasn't he? He still is a great guy, actually, Shaka. I love Shaka. He once at the Portsmouth promotion party, the players' promotion party, I don't know how I managed to get in, but I did, when they got promoted to the Premier League, he bought me a beer. Loved it. That should have been the other way around, really. Michelle, do you find that it's easier when you're working in League One, League Two, Championship to get to know the characters rather than if you're being dispatched to a Premier League game?
100%, yeah. Yeah, I was with Crook down in Bournemouth the other week and it's all sort of very clinical, the way players are brought through one by one. There's a press officer by their side all the time, whereas I can walk down the Bristol City Tunnel and stop and have a chat with their striker, Matty Taylor, about his little kid or about taking his kid swimming or whatever. League One and League Two even more so. And then when you go to those games, you might see sort of assistant coaches from other teams. Like last weekend, I saw Warren Feeney, who's now at Notts County with Harry Kewell. And you can just have a chat with him and just sort of, you know, nothing for sort of publication, but just get a background knowledge on what's going on at certain clubs and just great little nuggets of information that you would just never get in the Premier League. And yeah, the players most of the time are quite approachable when you can have a chat with them.
I was at a glitzy ITV sort of gala thing on Tuesday night, and despite
the
fact
photos?
That I
was going to say, did you go to that? I don't think you've mentioned it, have you?
Hey, I thought I looked quite good in my dinner jacket. But I did. I bumped into Mark Chamberlain, who I know very, very well from a previous incarnation. And it's Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's dad. And I started talking to him and his wife about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, saying, you know, the World Cup must have been difficult. And they were saying, yeah, do you know what? We're basically booking our flights to Russia. And one son broke his leg whilst playing for Portsmouth. And then straight away, Alex has done his injury. And he was just discussing the fact that he's getting really frustrated about how long it's taking to repair. Because I think Jürgen Klopp said at the beginning of the season, he's going to be out probably for the whole of the campaign. But I think years ago, the injury that he has, they would probably give it sort of 6 to 7 months before he was back and sort of integrating in training. But now, because the re-rupture rate was so high, they're giving it so much longer and they're not risking it. So they've basically said to him, don't worry about this season. And I think he's sort of now getting to the point, you know, a couple of months in, they're flying, they're doing well, he's watching from the sidelines, where he's getting really frustrated. But, you know, that's another sort of example of someone who you knew from a long time ago, you meet, you chat and discuss things, and then you get information that way as well. So, yeah, the background information is really important. And when I'm doing Liverpool this weekend, I'll probably use that at some point, I would have thought. We do have some questions, by the way. I think you put it out on Twitter as well, Crook, about the need for questions this week. Sean Dealing's got in touch via our website, which is afcgeeks.com. He says, I've really enjoyed the first couple of episodes. Quick question for you all. Is there any team player stadium that you haven't covered but really want to? Michelle?
Liverpool. Yeah, definitely. That's an easy one. I've never been to Anfield. I've seen some of your videos sort of behind the scenes there, Sam. I know you go there a fair bit. It's just one of those grounds that I'd really love to go to, because I used to go out with a boy whose family were Liverpool obsessed, and I don't support Liverpool, but it got me quite into them. And it's just one of those grounds that I really want to go to. I want to cover a game there, and just waiting, fingers crossed.
Crook, I know you're a massive Manchester United fan, but you've got to admit that a European night under the lights at Anfield, in the old words of the cliche, is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I've never done a European night at Anfield. I have done games at Anfield, and I have to say it is quite spine-tingling when they sing You'll Never Walk Alone. In terms
of
a
Manchester United fan?
Yes, I probably shouldn't be admitting that publicly. But in terms of a stadium, I've been with you and watched a game at the Allianz Arena. I've never commentated there. I know you have, so maybe that's on my bucket list. In terms of the big grounds in England, I'm quite lucky, actually. I've done pretty much all of the big arenas in this country.
I've done most of the big stadiums in the UK and Europe, I think. There's nothing that stands out for me. I would love to do a game in the big house in Detroit, Michigan. The huge, huge stadium, which hosted a game between Liverpool and Manchester United not so long ago, and I think it was nearly 100,000 people there. I'd like to do that. I'd like to do a game in America, I think. That's where I'd really like to do a match. Mm. Sean also says, you have slightly different roles for matches, so how does the prep differ for commentator, reporter and journalist? What sort of prep do you do, Michelle?
I think it's very different, because, Sam, obviously you're there for 90 minutes and you've got your highlighters, and I see commentators set up differently because they're often on the gantry near us, and they might have like post-it notes or stickers for formations and interchange them when the lineups come out. Whereas because on Soccer Saturday, for example, you're sort of doing a 20, 30 second update, you do your research into the players before, but you sort of only need a line or two on each one because you won't be able to give much more info than that. And then I have like 2 pages of stats for a championship game, and I'll pick out a few from Opta. So not anywhere near as much as you would have, Sam. And then what I do is I draw a line down the middle of an A4 page. I'll have Brentford on Saturday on the left-hand side, Bristol City on the right. I'll have corners at the top, a little C, and then I mark how many corners they've had and things like that. And then I just write the chances on each side, which each side has had. Whereas a commentator, I think, is so different because you're constantly talking. You have to be able to just look down and pick out what you need, whereas I might be able to keep going back to it and have a few things in the back of my head ready for my update. So it is quite different.
Yeah, from my point of view, pretty similar to Michelle in terms of the difference between doing a full commentary and the updates. I pretty much prepare for a match day live game the same as Michelle would for Soccer Saturday, whereas obviously for full commentary, I go into much more detail and have much more stats. I'd always have the stat pack open in front of me for match day live in case I need to refer to it. But in terms of newspapers, that's a different thing altogether. You're looking for a headline, particularly as most of my stuff is for the tabloids. For example, when I covered Bournemouth Blackburn in the Cup a few weeks ago for the Mirror, I knew that Junior Stanislas was making his comeback. So already before he scored his goal, I had the sort of comeback king intro in my head. Also put a few quid in him, by the way, so that was happy days. And he did score the goal. So pretty much my intro is written before the game kicked off.
I think there's a massive difference between doing, for me, a live radio game, a live television game, and a highlights game, for example. If you're doing a highlights television game, you don't need anywhere near as much stuff. But I have a real problem in trying to stop doing the same amount of work. I always seem to do the same amount, whether I'm doing television, radio, or highlights, and I really don't need to do that. I mean, I think you need more when you're doing television, because there's more sort of discussion points and there's more for you to talk about around the game. When you're doing radio, you are talking all the time, but you're talking mainly about what's happening, because your job is to paint the picture. So you probably don't need as much as I do. Most of it's wasted, I've got to be honest with you. I reckon I'll probably do 8 hours to 16 hours for every single game that I do, and I waste 80% of it. Most of it never gets used. I mean, it's just pointless. But next week, I've been asked to do Match Day Live. So Adrian Durham, who presents Talk Sport's main flagship programme on a Saturday, is off. So they've asked me to do it. And it's not the first time I've done it. I've done it a few times, but it's the first time I've done it Saturday afternoon with Premier League and loads of stuff going on. And I've got to be across every team who's playing that day at 3 o'clock. And I'll be honest with you, I've already started doing it now.
There's two Football League games for each club between now and then as well.
Mm. So what I'll do is I'll start writing out the sheets. In terms of what I did last night was, is I wrote down the fixtures. That's what I did. Just get the first like batch of fixtures out, leave certain spaces in my book, and then I'll just slowly but surely just keep updating it as I go along. Any little relevant pieces of information. I can't do stats until the day before, because as you just said, there's games in between time for all those teams, so it's very difficult to do that. But like just the little basic bits of information will all be filled in over the next couple of days, which is pretty sad on my part. Yeah, that's what I'll be doing instead of going out on Friday night.
So if you've got any burning questions for us, we can get onto those next week. Just find us on Instagram or Twitter. We are at AFC Geeks on both of them. And you can subscribe there, tell everyone about us as well. And we'll get to some of those questions next week.
We are out of time for another edition. Thank you very much to everyone who's downloaded it. Please keep telling all your friends about it. It's been really good so far. And we want to keep the numbers going up and up and up. Crook, have a good weekend.
Will do. You too, Sam.
And Michelle, we'll see you soon.
Yeah, that's if I can find anywhere to park at Brentford. I've been told there's no parking on Saturday.
Oh, I had a nightmare there once.
Hope I can find my way in and out. Oh no, Crook, don't tell me that. Oh,
it was awful.
It was a Tuesday night. I got stuck in M4 traffic getting there. I was on the air at 7. I got to the stadium at 6, and it took me 45 minutes to find a parking space. I actually got into the ground 10 minutes before I was joined air.
The good news for you, though, is that there's 4 pubs, one on each corner of the ground, and there's a McDonald's just down the road.
Right, stop. There's 4 pubs on the corner. That's great, but I'm working, so I can't have a drink. Secondly, McDonald's and vegetarian. Come on, Sam.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.